In the interest of beginning pretty close to our scheduled time for the open forum, and in an effort not to destroy entirely the informality that we desire to have when just a few of us gather like this in the seminary's living room, we're going to make a couple of remarks here to prime the pump, and then we're going to ask you to ask us questions and make comments about anything that's on your mind. Perhaps we'll even manage to be talking about the same thing. Let me give you a kind of a blow-by-blow report of things that have been happening in the last few weeks and tell you a little bit about some of the things that are scheduled to be happening in the next few days. First of all, I think some of you may have heard the latest enrollment statistics for the seminary, and they're very encouraging, at least to those of us who like to see Concordia's enrollment grow. The registrar's official figures at the beginning of this quarter were 207, but Mrs. Brenner told us this afternoon that three additional students had enrolled, making the present total 210. You will remember we began the year with 193, which at that time we felt was a remarkable number of students, considering the limited time that we had had to get underway. But 210 is even better, particularly when you keep in mind that during the year we have had some students leave us to begin their vicarage assignments and to assume a call in one or two cases. We have had only one student leave Concordia Seminary for another student body, and that was a first-year student who transferred to Seminex at the end of the first quarter. The breakdown by classes, and this is still based on the 207 figure, is 58 first-year, 32 second-year, 49 in the third year, 36 seniors, 7 special students, 25 graduate students. We're also rather encouraged here about the outlook for next year's enrollment. I think the word has gotten around to many of you that the preliminary enrollment figures for next year's first-year class appear to be at about 100. In about the middle of January, we had a report from the senior college that out of their 125 students going on for seminary training next year, 51 had indicated the preference that they would be, their preference to come here, and asked that their transcripts be sent here and nowhere else. An additional 16 asked that their transcripts be sent here and to one other school. 15 students indicated that they had no preference at this time, and the remaining 44 were divided between Seminex, Springfield, and other Lutheran seminaries. We don't know how that 44 figure is to be broken down, but if you would assume that, let us say, 4 out of the 44 were going to other Lutheran seminaries and would divide the remaining 40 equally between Springfield and Seminex, I think you can see what that means as of January 15. 51 for Concordia Seminary St. Louis, approximately 20 for Springfield, 20 for Seminex, and the remainder undecided or going elsewhere. In addition, we have received letters from more than 40 students in other schools. Sometimes those schools are within our system, in other cases they are not, so that we are reasonably sure, given stability in people's intentions, of about 95 or 100. And we have, we think, good indications from an additional 50 or so that they are giving us serious consideration. Within the last week or 10 days, I have received letters from 2 Seminex vicars transferring to Concordia Seminary. The reason given is that they have decided that they want to be pastors in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod rather than in some other church. I find the reason almost as interesting as I do the fact that they have come back to Concordia Seminary. Their questions also reveal the great amount of misinformation that must be given to these young men. Both of these letters, I don't know, John, whether you, I think you got copies. I hope you have, because they're rather interesting. Wondering what they have to do to atone for the fact that they were not with us this past year or haven't been sending their vicarage reports? Will we make them go to school for an extra year and that kind of thing? So we're happy to tell them, as we will be to tell any others that we have the opportunity to do so, that there is no penalty, none whatsoever, that their credits will be accepted as credits in good standing, and we're delighted to have them back. Some things have been happening in the faculty. Dr. Klotz will be talking, I guess, about some of our staffing needs and perhaps making some requests of you to tell us about all the good teachers that you know about whom we might consider. But there are some other things that I could mention, too. First of all, last week when the Council of Presidents were in town, we had an opportunity to visit with the Council of Presidents as a faculty. We spent about an hour and a half in small groups one afternoon talking about our mutual goals and interests in theological education. And then we hosted the Council of Presidents to beverages and dinner and had a very fine opportunity to get to know these people informally. And we hope that they also got to know us in a pleasant social setting. The faculty, let's see, I have a few other things here that you might be interested in. You perhaps have heard of our recent decision in the faculty to change our catalog policy of transfer credits to Concordia Seminary. We had, for the past few years, allowed up to 2 years of seminary work from an accredited seminary to be transferred to Concordia Seminary. The faculty has changed that policy to the point where only 1 year as a maximum will be allowed of this kind of transfer credit. This is to some extent in Dean Klotz's area, and if you're interested in knowing more about the reasons for that, I'm sure that John will be glad to tell you. This will not become effective immediately. That is, it is not retroactive. Nobody will lose ground on account of a change in policy, but the intention here is to allow Concordia Seminary to have students for a longer period of time before we certify them for the Holy Ministry. This is, by the way, the same requirement that the Springfield Seminary has, and we feel that it's about time that Concordia Seminary tries to establish at least as high of standards as our sister seminary at Springfield has. Thirdly, the faculty has repeated the offer it made last fall to Seminex seniors this year, whereby two-thirds of a year of courses on our campus will be regarded as meeting our requirements for certification. For many years, the catalog here has stated that the last full year of academic work prior to certification for the ministry was a requirement. We relaxed that to two-thirds of a year last November. We have repeated that statement just recently, and a letter was sent to the Seminex seniors recently reminding them of that particular program. The faculty has no intention at this point of offering an interview program or of any other alternate for the reception of our certification. We feel that we have not had these students in class at all. That's true of most of us, at least. And it has been a long, long time since any of them were under our supervision or in our classrooms or in touch with us in any way, shape, or form. It would simply be irresponsible, we feel, for us to be a party to any kind of half-hour interview process or anything similar to that for men whom we really do not know. But we would be delighted to have any Seminex senior of this year spend 24 hours with us in the classroom, and at that point we would be happy to give him his MDiv degree and certify him, provided he meets all of our academic and theological requirements. We're going to go to the semester system at Concordia Seminary year after next. More accurately, it's called a 414. You have to call it something a little different these days, otherwise people might get the idea that this was another instance of Concordia Seminaries being locked in some pre-medieval scholastic tradition, and we're trying to make it sound very, very modern. So we're going to call it 414 isn't modern anymore, John. That's been around about 3 or 4 years. I think maybe we ought to...
We'll cook up another term.
Yes, I think that'd be real good. John will tell you more about the semester system and what it will mean. The profs are hoping it will mean less work, and my reports are that the students hope the same thing. Maybe if we put our heads together, we can come up with something useful here. I hope so. Today in our faculty meeting, we certified for the Holy Ministry 3 more graduates of Seminex from last year. That brings the number certified to 18. It's my unofficial count. We have interviewed 27 Seminex graduates at this point, according to my memory. And we're batting 18 out of 27. 2 of the 27 interviewed were not eligible for the program. We knew that in the case of one man. He knew it, we knew it, but we interviewed him anyhow because 2 of the people doing the interviewing have some remote connection with Synod's colloquy board. I'm one of those. And we felt that if he were not eligible for our program, perhaps the colloquy program might receive him and consider the interview by 2 or 3 of us to be adequate. At any rate, 2 were ineligible, and the other 7 are still being processed by Concordia's placement committee. In the case of all 7 of those men, when interviewed by the faculty committee, they submitted statements in writing as we had requested them to, and they knew in advance that we were requesting it, and in their statements used language that was extremely hostile, and in the judgment of the interviewers, that is of the faculty interviewers at least, we felt revealed some problems that needed further attention before we would be willing to say to the church, as the bylaws of the church require us to, that this man is in every respect qualified for the office of the Holy Ministry. And we have pursued that hesitation caused by their language, not by our demands. We have pursued that by writing a very friendly letter to each of these men, asking him, what did you mean when you said such and such? And would you please give us some further explanation of why you used that kind of language in talking about this faculty? I don't think the church would have too much difficulty understanding our concern. And it may be necessary, after the publicity that has appeared in the current issue of Missouri in Perspective, for us to share with the church the kind of verbal abuse these young men are capable of dishing out to those with whom they disagree. If you think that a responsible faculty should tell the church that a man is ready for the ministry who speaks of the Board of Control and others here as trampling over dead bodies and similar rhetoric, then you have a different understanding of what a pastor is supposed to be than we do on the faculty of Concordia Seminary. I categorically reject the statement in Missouri in Perspective that I made any kind of guarantee to President Ellerman or anyone else that we would not ask for further clarification of any written statement. As a matter of record, and there is a record, the whole conversation was tape recorded by President Ellerman with my consent. The record will show that we specifically told the young men that their written statement would without doubt cause considerable difficulty for our faculty, and especially for our faculty placement committee. So, we continue to hope that we will not have to tell the church that angry young men are indeed qualified for the ministry. We want these men to get rid of their anger and hostility, to learn to express their criticism in a calm, Christian, fraternal, rational way, and when they do that, we will be happy to declare them eligible for the high office of the Holy Ministry. 1 or 2 other items. and then we'll turn it over to Dean Klotz for his comments and your questions. The Board of Control of Concordia Seminary will be meeting this weekend on our campus, beginning Friday at 2 o'clock, and continuing, I would imagine, until about the same time on Saturday. As is its fashion, the Board of Control, although it meets every month, manages to have its usual amount of work. This is its agenda for this coming meeting. You sometimes may wonder what Helen and I do over in that office. We don't know most of the time, but I would say at least 40% of the time we're working on next month's agenda or mailing out the letters that we were asked to mail in the previous meeting. For the most part, the major agenda item of the Board of Control is the adoption of its report to the Anaheim Convention. The deadline for that is this weekend. We have been granted a special dispensation to hand it in at 8 a.m. Monday morning, for which everyone's very grateful for that, except my wife, who will no doubt end up typing it. But the report is a very difficult one, both to write and to expect unanimity on in the Board of Control. It deals with some of the most difficult and sensitive issues in the history of the seminary, and I don't think that's any exaggeration. The task was made a little bit easier by the opinion we received a little over a week ago from the Commission on Constitutional Matters, telling the Board of Control that it is not free at this point to release publicity on the Teachin case. The first draft of the board's report had about a 10-page summary of the board's handling of the Teachin case, plus two appendices, which were planned to be rather long and rather detailed. Both appendices have been removed, and the section on the Teachin case has been reduced to a bare minimum. Even so, there are sections in here on the following subjects. The faculty protest. Remember that one? July 24, 1973. The board's handling of Resolution 309. The Teachin case is the next heading. Faculty and student exodus is the next heading. And so it goes. Somewhere along the line, yes, the major part of it, as far as I'm concerned, is the second half called Concordia Seminary Today, where we mention all of the good things we could think of about Concordia Seminary and did it as briefly as possible. So the report is one thing. There are some 30 or 40 other items on the agenda, none of them too exciting, of course, with the exception of your report, John, which you know how that always turns everybody on. So we're going to have another one of these reports from the academic dean and all of the other administrative officers, which the board usually flips through real quickly because it's non-controversial. I might mention one of the things being reported to the board is the results of the nominations for the seminary presidency. Give you a 3 or 4 day advance piece of information there. At the end of the nomination period on February 28, 73 letters of nomination had been received, nominating 14 candidates for the job. An additional 12 letters were received, nominating 6 other persons, but they came from individuals not eligible to nominate, so they weren't counted. The election itself will be on May 3. The names of the nominees plus an invitation to send in anything good, bad, or indifferent on any or all of them will appear in the March 16 issue of the Lutheran Witness. I learned yesterday, and I'll be reporting to the Board of Control, that the State of Illinois Department of Public Instruction is calling a hearing on the 26th of March on the question of the granting of degrees to last year's Seminex graduates by the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. And our Board of Control has been invited to send 2 representatives to that hearing, and I would imagine that we will cooperate. John, you're going to tell us, aren't you, about the CCM opinion?
Yes.
The Commission on Constitutional Matters has issued two opinions on the teaching case that I think you will find interesting, and I'll let John tell you about that. And perhaps the accreditation report would also be of interest to the people. We had a consultant who has been with us a couple of times this year, Dean Warren Groff from Bethany Seminary in Chicago. He is the dean of that seminary, a member for many years of the Commission on Accrediting of the American Association of Theological Schools, a first-rate theological educator, has been retained by Concordia Seminary for special consultation this year in dealing with our accreditation problems. At the end of his recent visit, he submitted a rather lengthy report to us on his impressions of Concordia Seminary, and we were very gratified to find that, in his judgment, we are making very good progress toward remedying some of the more obvious problems caused by the exodus of last year. And if you'd like to talk a little more about that one, John, I'm sure everybody would be interested in that. My last item, I think, has been announced on campus, and that was that the plans are proceeding nicely for a day of theological reflection on campus. The date picked is April 24, and the theme is the work of the Holy Spirit, not only as it pertains to the charismatic movement or the neo-Pentecostal movement, as some prefer to call it, but simply to talk together, to study the Word together, and to listen to one another as we consider the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives and in our church today. I don't know any more of the details at this point on the program, but it does sound like a very good day indeed. So I think I'll yield to my right hand man. John, you're to my right
to the
tonight.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if that's significant. Why don't you
tell
us about some of the things that you have in mind, and then we can have some questions and answers.
I'm not going to upstage you, but I'm going to update you.
Oh, that's good.
I had two phone calls, one yesterday and one today from Fort Wayne, and these are the figures they give me. Dr. Waltz tells me that they expect somewhere between 60 and 80 of this year's graduates to enroll here. And today I was talking to Dr. Bredemeyer, and I asked him how many he thought would be going to Seminex. He said they have between 20 and 30 who have indicated that they plan to go to Seminex. So this will give you some idea of where we stand, which I think is very good. If we can get between 60 and 80 graduates from Fort Wayne, I think this will be a very happy thing for our enrollment. Now, a few words about staffing. You probably know that the Board of Control issued a number of calls in its last meeting. Dr. August Silflo was called as adjunct professor of historical theology. Some of you have had him in class, and if you haven't had him, you've seen Mrs. Silflo floating around next to Dr. Bowman's office. Dr. Martin Schmidt was called. Mrs. Schmidt is right over there this evening. We also called Dr. Martin Henschke of Milwaukee, Concordia College, Milwaukee. His particular area of expertise is counseling. He's another one of these men who has two earned doctorates. And we're very hopeful that he will accept the call. He will be teaching courses in counseling, particularly in the School for Graduate Studies, and then will be working in the seminary counseling program. We'll really be heading up the seminary's counseling program. We've also called Dr. George Robert, who is associate professor of history at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. His area of interest is church history from the Council of Nicaea up through the period of the Lutheran Reformation. And I know he's going to make a substantial contribution to our program if he decides to join us. I do believe that he too will be joining us. I talked to him by phone yesterday. We are continuing to explore our needs in other areas as well. We think that we are adequately staffed in exegetical theology, and if Dr. Silflo and Dr. Robert accept the calls extended to them, in historical theology. We do have a need in systematic theology, and as Dr. Bowman said, if you have any suggestions for somebody who is competent in this area, we certainly would be happy to receive that. I might share with you the criteria that we have for men to do teaching at the seminary. We would like to find men who are not only loyal to Scripture and the confessions, but who also have an advanced earned degree, preferably a doctorate, who have had prior teaching experience, and who have served in the parish ministry. This is the sort of person we are looking for. So we have a need in systematics, and the other area in which we have a need is in practical theology. We are hopeful that very shortly we will be extending an appointment in the area of practical theology, but we still have need in this particular area. So the two areas in which we have need at present are in systematic theology and in the various areas of practical theology. Dr. Bowman mentioned that the faculty today resolved that beginning in 1976-77, we will be developing our program on a semester system. The plan is to have a program consisting of two semesters and an interterm. The first semester would extend from September until Christmas. Then the interterm would take place in January, and the second semester would begin the last week in January and go into May. They would be approximately 15-week semesters. Now, how the program will look, we don't know at this time. We're just taking the first steps. We've just made the decision that we are going to develop a semester program. We think that probably during the interterm, in at least two of the years the student is here, he will have an elective. One suggestion that has come to us is that possibly in the second year, some students do their education practicum in the interterm, because from the reactions we've been getting from the supervising teachers that we've used, we think that there would be marked advantages to having the student spend the whole day at the congregation where he's serving to see the whole education program. At the present time, the student is exposed to the religion lesson and sees really only the religion lesson. But if he could spend all day, he could see the entire program of the parish school plus the other educational programs which are conducted by the congregation. Now, we probably would not have all of the teaching practicum in the interterm, but this is one example of what might be done during the interterm. Another suggestion has been that we use that time for a tour to the Holy Land, or a tour to Asia Minor, to the land of the lands of St. Paul. That sort of thing can be done during the interterm. It can't very well be done during the year. Springfield did have such a program and has attempted to conduct a similar program, but ran into difficulties because of the conflict with other classes. So it seems to me that there are real possibilities in the interterm. So we'll be moving in that direction. I should also say this, that there will be some reorganization of the program of studies. Probably we will try to combine courses as much as possible. Instead of having several courses in the confessions, we may very well have only one course in the confessions, possibly five semester hours in confessions, but it would be just in one semester. We might also combine homiletics and worship. This has been suggested, that there is some overlap in the homiletics and worship courses, and maybe we can combine them. So we would like to reduce the number of courses in the required core. Now, that doesn't mean that we would be reducing the number of hours that would be devoted to them, but you would take fewer courses in the required core. We hope also to provide some options. One suggestion that has been made is that in church history, a student be given his choice, if assuming that he has come through the system and has had some church history. But he would be able to take a two-semester church history course, which would cover the entire gamut of church history from the time of the apostles to the present, or if he felt that he had had a good overview of church history, he might choose one course in the history of the early church, one course in the medieval church, one course in the Reformation, and one course in the church in America. And in that way, he credit-wise, he would have the same amount of work in, but he would have gone deep into a few selected areas rather than covering the whole broad period of church history. We think this has some very real possibilities and some very interesting possibilities. We also are planning to offer chiefly electives on a module system so that a student would take a course for 7.5 weeks and then shift to another course for 7.5 weeks. Now, they would not have to be in the same area, but this would be essentially in the area which of his electives, and instead of taking one course for 15 weeks, he'd break that up into two courses. This would provide greater variety so that the student would be able to cover a broader area. He wouldn't dip as deeply into the particular area, but he would be able to cover more areas in his program. Now, all of this is going to require a lot of attention on the part of the faculty. Our goal is to have the program pretty well in shape by the end of this school year, and then we hope that faculty members will begin work on some of the courses for the semester program this summer already, and then next year we hope to get them into real good shape and be ready to go then in September 1976. Then let me comment on the letter which I wrote to the Seminex profs. I see that In Touch has commented on it, and somebody told me that there was a reference to it in Missourian Perspective. It seems as though some feel that this is a PR gesture. It was sent because both Dr. Bowman and I have heard repeatedly that there are former faculty members who would like to be considered for teaching positions here at Concordia Seminary. And so in response to the this assertion, which we've heard again and again, once more, and Dr. Bowman did this in the early fall or late summer, I don't recall when, but I know you, at some time a letter was addressed to the men. He received a few responses. And so once more, a letter was addressed to them, calling their attention to the fact that the Board of Control, of course, would want to discuss their attitude over against the matters mentioned in Resolution 309, and then also their attitude over against the faculty protest. But that if they wanted to be considered, they should inform us. We are honestly inquiring as to whether there is interest. Then Dr. Bowman referred to the visit of Dr. Groff. I think we were all very pleased with his reactions. Some of you students may have met with him. We arranged it so that he would eat in the dining hall and have the opportunity to meet with students. He did a very careful evaluation of our program here, that is as careful as he could do in the 2 days he was here, and gave us some very interesting comments. It was his general feeling that the students are happy with the program that they have here, that they are satisfied with the efforts that are being made, that they have a very optimistic outlook with regard to the future. His comments were in the same vein so far as faculty is concerned. He told us that One of the things that remained to be seen was whether the faculty could be brought together as a team. He felt that we were making strides in that direction, but he urged us to do whatever we could to continue to work toward that goal of an integrated teaching team. He was very favorably impressed with the library facilities, with the library resources. I think one of his most complimentary statements was made over against Professor Bielenberg, whom he said had a great deal of ability and was carefully planning. He was very complimentary about the library. He felt that we certainly had enough students for our MDiv program, also for our STM program. He was concerned about the number of students in the THD program and also in the MAR program. And he encouraged us to do what we could to build it up. He did say that he thought it would be worth someone sitting down with the Board of Control to discuss their particular role and functions. And then he listed several areas in which he felt we would profit from additional consultation. And I have already written him. When he was here, he indicated that he might be willing to serve as a consultant in some of these areas, although not all of them. And I have already written him, inviting him to indicate dates on which he would be free to come down and talk to us about these particular areas. Our feeling is that he is well qualified to evaluate our program because he is sympathetic to our doctrinal position. He is a member of the Church of the Brethren, a conservative church body, and I believe that he understands us a lot better than some of the other members of the Commission on Accrediting. So my own contacts with him, I met with him a number of times in the last couple of years on accreditation matters, and he's a very quiet person in the commission meetings, but he did impress me as one who was very fair and sympathetic to what we were trying to do. Then finally, let me comment on the CCM opinions. I did not participate in the voting on either of the items which affect Concordia Seminary, because I think you can understand that I have somewhat of a conflict of interest there. I was present for the discussions, and I did serve as a resource person. The other members of the CCM asked me questions. One of the matters that had to be decided was the district president to whom the teaching report should be turned over. Now, there was some question there. The bylaws are not as clear as they might be, and I was on the task force that wrote those, so I think we found out they were not as clear as they might have been. But I should tell you, I understand Missourian Perspective knows that there was a vote already in the December meeting, knows what the vote was, and knows that some arms were twisted in the meantime. And that is totally false. There was no vote taken in the December meeting. There was discussion of the matter. It was not possible to resolve the issue because the CCM operates on a sort of devil's advocate system. Every attempt is made to explore a variety of possibilities. And then the men go home and they think it over. As I recall, in the December meeting, there were at least nine possibilities that were discussed and presented for decision. And then the men went back home and thought about it. They came into the next meeting and had some more questions. They asked me some questions in order to try to interpret this section, which the task force had written. Dr. Miller, who is secretary of the commission, was also on the task force, and he gave his impression. I have to say that we didn't always agree in what we understood the task force to meet meaning by some of the statements in the bylaws. But in any case, that decision then was reached that the report of the teach-in hearings should be turned over to Dr. Sherrod. And the basis for that is that in Section 109 and Section 680, it is very clear that Dr. Sherrod is the district president involved there. There's absolutely no question. The bylaws are very clear in stating that a faculty member is under the ecclesiastical supervision of the the president of the geographical district. There is no such statement in Section 6.79, which is the section involved. But the members of the CCM decided to move from Section 109 to Section 680 to Section 679. Now, on the other matter, there was a question as to whether the board's report on the teach-in matter could be released, whether the whether anything could be said in the report to the convention. The problem hinges on whether the Board of Control is a participant in further action, and secondly, whether this is an independent action or whether this is simply a continuation of the action begun by the Board of Control under Section 6.79. The Commission on Constitutional Matters reasoned that this was simply a continuation of Section 6.79, which I think goes up to N or O. And anyhow, they hooked on at Section 6.79L and said that under 6.79L, the Board of Control is required to turn the matter over to the district president of the individual. And they said that, in effect, that meant that Section 5 of the handbook hooks on to Section 6.79L and just is one continuous operation until the case is finally decided. And on that basis, they decided that Section 5.31J applies. And it's all very, very logical when you follow out the rationale that they adopted. So on that basis, it was decided that the Board of Control could not release any information on the Teejan case. Now, this section, 5.31J, states that while the case is under consideration or when there are, while there are an appeal is being taken or when an appeal is still pending, no publicity may be given to the case by anyone who is a party to the case. And as I see it, it seems to me that this is done primarily for the protection of the defendant in the case. And on that basis, in order not to prejudice the bodies that will be involved and in order not to prejudice the case, no publicity is to be given. Now, I'm sure what you are wondering is what happens from here on in. Well, under the bylaws, the transcript of the hearing must be turned over to the district president. The district president then receives this, and he may decide to turn the matter over to the Commission on Adjudication. If he turns the matter over to the Commission on Adjudication under the ruling of the CCM, he must suspend the individual from office. This would mean that he is suspended from the ministerium. He is not dropped, and he retains his rights, but he is suspended from office. And this notice then must be published in the Lutheran Witness. He must then, I believe within 15 days, turn the case over to the District Commission on Adjudication, so that the case then would pass to the Missouri District Commission on Adjudication. The Missouri District Commission on Adjudication is required to render a verdict within 3 months unless there is good reason for prolonging the case. The verdict of the District Commission on Adjudication may be appealed by either party to the Synodical Board of Appeals. Now, It is possible that the district president may decide not to turn the case over to the Commission on Adjudication. This is his prerogative, his judgment. The parties to the case may then appeal to the synodical president, who may, if he judges it desirable or warranted, turn the case over again to the district commission on adjudication. So that's another possibility. Just no one at this point knows what will develop. And with that, I'm going to stop, and maybe there are some questions to either of us.
Steve, why don't you start? Did you get all those bylaw numbers straight, Steve?
No, I'm afraid I didn't. Just out of curiosity, in the matter of an appeal in this sort of situation, is the appeal made from the record which is then given to the district president, or do the parties involved present,
The appeal, the Board of Appeals deals with the transcript of the hearing. Now, I would assume that this would be the transcript of the Board of Control hearing and the transcript of the hearing before the Commission on Adjudication. The Board of Appeals may also seek other information. This is its prerogative. It is not bound to have another hearing, but it may seek additional information. Its decision, however, really is supposed to be based on the record and any additional testimony which it seeks is for purposes of clarification.
I think I heard you say that, I'm sure you were talking about 6.79. Did you said the board would be going to L?
Yeah. They are at L.
Oh,
there'd
be a lot of people that would be interested to encourage them in that direction.
Wait, it only goes to M. I thought it went to N and O. It only goes to M. We're almost at the end of the... Yeah, we're almost at the end of
it. I think you're slipping. I noticed as you were reciting all those bylaw numbers, a lot of smiles and so
alphabet
on.
Alphabet soup.
Yeah, you're working too hard. Yeah.
The Commission on Constitutional Matters also ruled something about the district president, didn't they, or something, or was that a...
Oh, yes. We've had this under consideration for at least two meetings. I think, it's been longer than that. I'm sure we've had that under consideration for at least three meetings, and this, interestingly enough, I think, is a commentary on the fact that Missourian Perspective seems concerned that we took two meetings to decide who was the district president. The matter of the district president's being faulted for malfeasance and misfeasance and nonfeasance in office, I know, was before us for at least three meetings. And the final ruling of the Commission on Constitutional Matters was that a distinction must be made between removing the district president from office and removing him from membership in the Senate and therefore from office. The commission ruled that he may be removed from office by the district convention, by the synodical convention, and in an emergency by the president of the Senate. And there are certain safeguards with regard to the latter situation. The president of the Synod must be prepared to demonstrate that it is indeed an emergency. Then he may be removed from his membership in the Synod in the same way in which any other pastor may be removed from the Synod. An individual or a group would bring charges, and these then could be brought to the District Commission on Adjudication. One of the questions there is on what would be the basis. Most of these cases, of course, deal with the ordination of seminary graduates. Now, is this false doctrine? Or is it, just what is it? Is it persistence in disobedient conduct, that sort of thing?
Why don't we, let's come back to you, Steve. Paul?
This teaching case now, does Dr. Scherr have the transcript already?
No.
Secondly, when he does get it, how much time does he have to make his decision?
He must decide promptly. which was not defined. But that's in the ruling, that he must decide promptly.
Does he have the power to defraud?
No, the case must go to the Commission on Adjudication. Now, there's another problem here that I might mention. There, in the bylaws, and we went through them rather carefully, because one of the men raised the question, we were not able to find any limitations on the time during which an appeal could be made, nor did we find any limitations on the time within which the Board of Appeals must make its findings.
Does that mean this could go on for a long, long time?
It would require another CCM opinion. In fact, that was the answer. If somebody wants to raise that question, let them come with it and make another request.
Let's see. I saw Steve's hand and then Tom. Steve?
Okay. This is not a teaching subject. No. How Permaplan isn't to change to a modified semester system? And what was your reading of the student body meeting in which this was discussed?
Yeah, this was discussed at that meeting. I would say the majority of students said that they would prefer to remain with the quarter system. Yeah. Subsequently, the three students who are on the APC came in and reported that they had discussed the matter with students and that their feeling was, in fact, what they were getting was, really, we should go to a semester system. And this was then reported to APC.
Who were the students on the APC?
Let's see. Andy Barteld, Jim Metcalf, and Frank Anderson. Those are the three students.
What kind of mechanics will there be for working out of credits earned under a quarter system?
Three quarter credits equal two semester credits. So if you are under the present program, you see, the student is always under the program that is in effect when he enters the seminary. In a way, he has the best of two worlds. That is, if requirements are reduced, he may meet the reduced requirements. He would have to meet the same total requirements. But let's just take this as an example. Suppose that in the new program, there were no isagogic requirements. He would still have to meet the requirements in exegetical theology, but he would not be required to take those isagogic courses. So, but the courses will be equated in that way. Now, where we're going to have the problem, of course, is from 76 on, and we're going to have to equate courses, and a student who would be taking a two-semester-hour course would get credit of three quarters.
Okay. Tom, I think you were next.
Since the teaching case is a little more closer to home for me and the semester system is rather remote, I'd like to go back if I can. First of all, I think in all the rhetoric that I'm hearing from both sides, one of the major charges, if I can use that phrase, against this administration and its board is the silence and is the lack of clear, definitive statements of what the charges were in regard to malfeasance and false doctrine in the teaching case. And as long as the board is quiet, it seems to me that the opposition to this can grow and nurture its particular cause. And the longer it takes for any kind of a definitive statement to come out, it seems to me the bigger the problem is going to become. Now, I'm only saying this from my limited contact with classmates and whatnot. So I don't know how this is affecting the entire church, but I do know that this is spawning further opposition the longer this thing is under the table. So I would appreciate your comments on that.
I'd be delighted to make some comments on that. I don't think anyone is more frustrated about this than the Border Control, unless it would be me. And I say it in a very serious sense. I think one serious moral question that must be raised by this imposition of silence is whether it permits people like me and you, who have access to the facts, to really discharge our Christian obligations under the Eighth Commandment to defend our neighbor. Because our brethren on the Board of Control, as well as men who have served in the administration of this seminary, and I suppose even the synodical administration, have been accused of nothing less than evil, injustice, silencing the Word of God. Just the latest press release I saw from Seminex, as printed in the current St. Louis Lutheran, again uses this strong language of judgment about this the raw legalism of the Board of Control. Well, this isn't just empty rhetoric. I know our ears have become somewhat deafened to a lot of this strong language, but I would hope that some of us have some moral sensitivity to what is really going on when Christian people who do their best to do what they believe is their duty under God and over against the church are subjected to that kind of name-calling and then put in a position where they cannot say what they did. This is a very serious moral question for me, and it is for many others, and I can assure you that no one wants to release the data more than the Board of Control, because they feel that once the church could read through the decisions from month to month that they made, could share the documents that they have seen, could hear the discussions presented by the Faculty Hearings Committee, which conducted an independent investigation on all of this material, a fact which the critics of the board know but never talk about. And once this kind of thing would be available, the church would at least see that the board proceeded in a meticulously careful fashion. The church might disagree with its judgment, but I do believe that the nature of that criticism would be tempered with a balance of Christian charity that is almost totally lacking on the Seminex side and the Elam side of things at the present time. For example, you frequently hear the charge, or we receive it in a resolution from some uptight pastoral conference or congregation somewhere, which is blessed with an ill-informed or uninformed or malinformed, boy, I like your prefixes, kind of pastor or other agent of misinformation, that says that the board didn't even tell Dr. Teachin what the charges were. Here's this poor man allegedly condemned for teaching false doctrine, and he doesn't even know what the charges were. Well, I don't know, you know, what to do with this kind of sheer, unmitigated nonsense. Dr. Teachin himself distributed to the church on the 21st of January, 1973, 90 pages of material pertaining to his case. He did so in violation of bylaw 5.31J, because he too was a party to the proceeding and is under the same strictures on publicity that the Board of Control is. And among the materials he released to the press and to all others who were interested are the transcripts that he had made from tape recordings he took of his Matthew 18 conversations with his accusers, as though this were the evidence in the case, which it is not. Now, in the midst of all that evidence, and many people have copies of it, you can read for yourself what the charges were against Dr. Teachin. The charges were defined by his accusers. All one has to do to know what the charges were against this man is to read what the materials that Dr. Teachin released. And I'm sure that he has read them, because they pertain to him. So I'm sure he knows what those charges were. There was a second occasion in the proceedings under bylaw 6.79 where Dr. Teachin was given full information as to the theological questions at issue. The bylaws would make that clear to anyone who read them carefully. 6.79D. I know my numbers
yep.
on that bylaw up to a point. At 6.79D, the Board of Control gets a theological opinion on the questions at issue from the Commission on Theology and Church Relations. And in the way this one was handled, as press release is already out on it from that time, we'll show, both the accusers and the defendant were given an opportunity to state whether or not the questions at issue as defined by the Board of Control were really to the point. And neither the accusers nor the defendant had any difficulty accepting the board's formulation of the theological questions at issue. They have all seen the long opinion rendered on all of those questions at issue, the theological questions at issue. And in Dr. Teachin's case and the accuser's case, that opinion has been in their hands since last summer. At a third stage, that's the stage at which the Faculty Hearings Committee report is shared with the Board of Control. It was also shared with the accusers and with the defendant. And again, that's in accordance with the bylaw provisions. The Faculty Hearings Committee report deals with those charges that are clearly in the public domain since Dr. Teachin himself released it. So I can think of at least three spots along the way in this long case where the theological questions at issue are, were spelled out in writing for all parties to the proceeding. Now, it's very, very disconcerting when this kind of information, and not a word that I have said tonight on this thing was new information. This is all in the public domain. It has been there for a long time. Anyone who reads press releases from the Board of Control or from Mr. Bryant's office can read the same thing. Anyone who reads this carefully would know how foolish it is to suggest that the Board of Control has never clarified for Dr. Teachin the charges that were against him. And it just doesn't make any sense. You may regard those charges as being poorly formulated or irrelevant, or feel that he is not guilty of those charges, but to suggest for one moment that he didn't know what they were, or that the board has been so irresponsible, so heartless, so legalistic, as not to even tell the defendant what the charges were, this I find almost preposterous. And yet, the situation is such in this church that letters signed, for example, by the deaconesses, a number of them, and deaconess students last October at Valparaiso, publicized throughout this church, accuse the Board of Control of utter insensitivity. That's about the mildest term I can think of, for something that they did not do. I don't know how you cut through this silence barrier. I am within a week of being ready to send to the printer a report on this whole case that approaches the length of a paperback book. Within 1 week, that's because I've had a lot of help gathering the data, putting it together in as objective a way as possible to share with the church, this is what happened. Here is the CTCR opinion. Here is the Faculty Hearings Committee report. Here are the resolutions of the board. This is the name of the attorney who was a former member of the American Bar Association's Committee on Ethics that was engaged to make sure that the work of the Faculty Hearings Committee was conducted with total fairness and concern for the defendant and this kind of thing. And by the way, we gave that attorney the kind of an option that you don't give to many people. We told him, sir, if at any point your advice to this committee is not followed, you are free to publicize it, to tell what your advice was, and to tell the world, if you'd like to, that it wasn't followed. Now we were prepared to turn the whole procedure of what is right and fair and honest and pure and all of that over to this man who has had an impeccable reputation in the legal community for his uprightness. That's how careful the Board of Control has been in this thing. You may disagree with their findings, but the repetition of the allegation that here are a bunch of heartless monsters who are somehow silencing the word of God, or who, you know, eat raw liver for breakfast so that they can grind everybody into oblivion and so on. This has gotten to the point of really concerning me morally. I wonder how much longer the Board of Control and others who are so ruthlessly accused will have to endure slander, because that's what it amounts to. Sorry for the sermon, but I wax eloquent after 14 hours of eating raw liver myself. Phil, I'm sorry I'm keeping you waiting, and I haven't heard you speak at an open forum since the first one we had. What are you going to tell us tonight?
No, Tom anticipated my question. All I was going to ask, too, is that I guess from the standpoint that I've heard, it's not so much the charges as the data behind them, the information underlying them, that because of its continual non-appearance, people tend to get the impression that the charges themselves, although stipulated, are groundless because there's been no information behind them. I know myself for a fact, information that I shouldn't know. In other words, I know that they are far from groundless. You know, and on that information, my personal opinion, if someone got to teach it, extremely low. You know, and I also feel that it should be publicized. I still have to take that nice department and handle it like this, it would still be not. And I feel that an immediate publication of the whole thing to the whole church, you know, tends to at least, a beginning to getting a handle on the, like you were talking about, the bombing the silence barrier, you know, and people simply to understand that our atmosphere to protect Dr. Teachin, you know, and the church at large, you know, from any later intimidation of unfairness or some sort of feeling that he was bumped out, you know, is really hurting ourselves. And
yes.
And also your words, this doesn't tell him anything. I mean, Tom said it better, but that was my concern too. That's all I
can. You can imagine my frustration sitting there and being able to speak only when spoken to.
Yeah. Well, the silence thing is, you know, that's a really odd thing. I have to give another example of this problem. The other Mother morning, this is Tuesday, isn't it? Yesterday, I was invited by the St. Louis Pastoral Conference to make a presentation on the question of the authority of the congregation in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And Dr. Bertram of Seminex was also on the program for that same conference. We were given equal time to speak to the subject. I spoke first. I suppose it was reverse alphabetical order or something. I usually end up speaking first on these things. Probably it's because everybody knows I'd rather speak second. But at any rate, I came in my usual unprepared way and spoke on the subject for about 20 minutes, which we'd been asked to speak. I sketched some of the questions involved, some of the relevant biblical, confessional, historical, and constitutional aspects of the question, gave a couple of opinions about things that were relevant, sat down. Dr. Bertram spoke and said that although the topic was congregational authority in the Missouri Synod, it was obvious that the question to be dealt with was the ordination of Seminex graduates. And he proceeded to talk for 20 minutes on the question of whether a congregation can ordain Seminex graduates, and in the middle of this, faulted me by name, along with the others in the Synod, for once again this morning failing to address myself to the real issue. Now, you know, I puzzle at such a move because it's so typical. While people are doing what they are asked to do, or carrying out a bylaw that they have a mandate to carry out, or an official is operating under the Constitution, which he has sworn in the name of the triune God to uphold, that second commandment ought to be resurrected sometime. I often think many things are going on by people who are using the name of God in vain. But, you know, then you're faulted for your silence on a topic I wasn't even invited to address. So I don't know what you do with silence. It's one of the other sides to this coin is at a recent meeting of some lay leaders, Paul, you know, the group we had over here at the group of laymen recently. We have a local Lutheran lay leadership group that has a fantastic amount of interest in Concordia Seminary. Last time we had expected about 150, and we ended up with 220 people over here for dinner, and they're just really enthused about Concordia and the whole cause that we feel ourselves committed to. We talked about this teaching report, this long thing that we want to share with the church. And there's considerable interest in that group, of course, in getting it out all over the Missouri Synod. And one of the things we were talking about was financing it. You know, many of them, this is would take several thousand dollars just to pay the postage for this thing. And of course, this group is very interested in considering it as a possible project. But one of the laymen stood up and said in the middle of the discussion, why don't we forget that report? Why don't we forget the teaching case? Why must we talk more and more about it? There's enough been written and said about it now for more than a year. The church is tired of it. Let's get on with the future. Let those people who want to continue talking about it talk about it. But let's get on with the future and forget it. Let's not put it out. And he was applauded by many people there. So I don't know, again, whether that's typical. It's unwise to generalize on the basis of one instance. But I have a feeling that he speaks for some people who don't particularly want the board to talk. You know, they're just tired of it.
You've got to be at a conference such as the one Dr. Bowman referred to. It's Alice in Wonderland. You wouldn't believe the point of view that is maintained, presumably with seriousness, that when someone does his duty, he's oppressing people. And he is using force and silencing the gospel because he's doing what he's sworn to do. It's fantastic. You just don't believe it until you hear it said.
Steve, you got another one?
Oh. I've got a comment. You know, when you say Alice in Wonderland, I mean, if you look at the editorial in Missouri in Perspective where Dr. Tietjen talks about the oppressiveness of Nazi Germany and the oppressiveness of the Synod, you know, my 9-year-old could figure out the analogy, but he doesn't quite draw. But also talking from silence, if Dr. Tietjen was so quick to publicize the initial proceedings, he's been rather slow to publicize the last proceedings, and yet he has all the records. Silence works both ways in a manner of speaking. But I have a question. At the Springfield, at the joint meeting of faculties for Springfield and Concordia, what happened?
Well, let's see. The first night we had a paper by Dr. Hummel on Psalm 1. After 45 to 50 minutes, he was on Psalm 1, verse 1, word 1. Remember that? I kept looking at that clock. Is it possible for Horace to go for a full hour on one word? And it was really well done. It was a pure delight for me personally to study the word. And, for one full hour, to just imagine, honestly open a book and learn something instead of opening a handbook or a Board of Control agenda or something. But it was a very, very fine presentation for a faculty because he was able to bring in questions and concerns that were matters in all departments, matters of interest, you know, things that the preachers like to know about and the systematicians. And he got an awful lot out of ashrei, the first word. That evening was the Springfield men were guests in our faculty homes and they visited. The next day we had department meetings together, and in each department there was a paper. Let's see, in systematics the paper was given by Scare, Dr. Scare of Springfield, and it dealt with some hermeneutical questions pertaining to the interpretation of the fall narrative. I don't recall what the other papers were. Perhaps John does. Then in the afternoon, we had at 11 o'clock, for 1 hour, we had an address by President Preuss, who spoke to us about some of the issues facing the church and how he felt they might be resolved. commended the faculties for doing their job well and told us that was the most important thing we could possibly do, was to be as good a faculty or faculties as possible. In the afternoon, we had a business meeting, and we received a number of recommendations for overtures from a resolutions committee. I said that carefully, recommendations for overtures. There were no overtures to Anaheim passed by the joint meeting, simply because the bylaws don't permit the joint faculty as such to submit overture, and both faculties are minded to obey the overture, the bylaws of the Senate. It might just as well in that case, since it wouldn't do any good to disobey it. Wouldn't be printed anyhow. And a number of these overtures, I think, some of them came up in our faculty this afternoon, and some no doubt will be coming up in the Springfield faculty, if they have not already, pertaining to matters of interest like recruitment of students. Do we need a special board for theological education in the Synod? What are the faculty's recommendations on the certification of Seminex grads? What should be done about Elam? What about district presidents who ordain contrary to the bylaws? I don't know. There were a whole bunch of things like that. And then we did spend some time on the question of the charismatic movement and the policies of the two seminaries on the admission and counseling, vicarage placement, and ministerial placement of men who are involved in the charismatic movement. The objectives of that meeting, like most joint meetings, are primarily to enable the faculties to get to know each other better and to share matters of, you know, common interest and concern. A lot of it's curricular. And that, I think, was really accomplished. There was a fine spirit of cooperation displayed. I think the two schools are really moving quite compatibly together and harmoniously together as we, you know, look at the problems facing the church. But I think the one resolution that was passed that I recall that relates to the synodical scene to some extent was a motion at the end of the meeting where the two faculties committed themselves to work toward reconciliation in the Missouri Synod on the basis of the Word of God, and reaffirmed a statement from the Lutheran confessional writings as expressing the joint faculty's convictions as to how such reconciliation should proceed. Now, if you can imagine a former confessions prop going someplace without a Book of Concord, that's what I did this evening. It just shows you, John. I walk around with a handbook and don't have a Book of Concord. But the statement that they reaffirmed is a marvelous statement. It occurs at the end of Article 11 of the Solid Declaration of the Formula of Concord. Want to read it? Or you want to say, why don't we read it when we quit tonight? That's coming up pretty soon. Okay? It's a kind of a doxological, but right on the money kind of statement. I'll keep it handy, Dave, will you? Okay. I think you can't find a better staff than that, can you? They come prepared. Let's see, who hasn't had a question? Okay, good.
I'd like to ask a question concerning recruitment, particularly recruitment being done by Seminex at other synodical schools. And I guess it's a compound question. Is there any official statement on this? And if there is, what is being done to... enforce such a statement?
There is a statement, first of all. The statement was adopted by the Board for Higher Education on March 11, 1974. Aren't you impressed with my photographic recall of things like that? I happen to have another letter dated February 17, 1975 in the Board of Control agenda, and I can read it to you. We have been informed that a recent publication of this comes from the BHE. We have been informed that a recent publication of Seminex indicated that special teams were going out to schools, including synodical schools, for the purpose of recruiting students. In a policy statement issued March 11, 1974, the Board for Higher Education outlined its responsibilities and resolved that each Board of Control immediately take all necessary and possible action to protect the present and future welfare of their students, faculty, and staff from becoming involved in Seminex, supporting Seminex, or providing encouragement to Seminex. Your question as to what's being done about that resolution is, well, depending on what you mean by what's being done, this coming weekend, Fort Wayne will be visited by a team of 10 Seminex professors and 30 Seminex students.
Well, it has been.
Has? Was that last weekend?
Yeah, last week, finishing up, I guess, last night, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, well, probably have a smaller number of students and faculty up there next weekend. They don't, President Brademeyer at the Fort Wayne Senior College, and I want to say this loudly and clearly, does not approve of Seminex recruitment teams on the campus of the senior college, and has been extremely fair to us and to Springfield and to any synodical representative coming on that campus, and has also been, I think, has done as much as any president could do to try to keep the Seminex people off the campus for recruitment purposes. But what is done, as I understand it, is that they have meetings in the vicinity of the school. They find some local eliminators, local Elim people who invite students over, invite faculty members over, and I think make the contacts in that way, unofficially and so on. And I don't really know too much can be done about it, and I don't know that I would want to put a stop to it. I really think that the Seminex people ought to make their pitch. Almost every place where it has occurred, it has helped us rather than hurt us. I say that, I don't mean that facetiously. I feel sorry for people that must promote themselves by demoting someone else. I really feel sorry for the Seminex people who do that, who feel that their strongest argument for going to Seminex is that we are evil. And I don't know. I think they're hurting themselves with that kind of approach. Now, Dave, you're our recruitment man. Are you familiar with anything that would help in response to that question?
I think you summarize as much as we really know. Mm-hmm. Other than choirs coming through town, they seem to manage to help most of them.
Yeah.
In one way.
Right.
One of the problems in response to this question is that the handbook does not really provide for any way of dealing with people who do not keep their obligations. The handbook was written with the assumption that people would live up to their contracts. The handbook is a contract. And everyone assumed that once the majority decision had been reached, people would respect it, even though they might disagree with it. And so, really, the way of dealing with people who don't live up to their contractual obligations isn't spelled out in any great detail. There are some generalizations there, but really not an adequate machinery for dealing with people who don't live up to their oaths of office and to their contractual obligations.
Phil? I'm sorry?
Was there anyone else that wanted to?
I don't know. Has anyone not had a chance to ask the question it wants to? We're kind of taking turns tonight. Hey, you're in luck.
President Bowman, was anything decided about in terms of a tentative policy or a suggested policy about the charismatic thing, the joint faculty meeting? I'm kind of interested in that. I was interested in inquiring about it afterwards on the basis of, you know, this sort of general rumor type thing that from time to time, vigorous, although good-natured, you know, discussion rose about certain points, not just the charismatic thing, and apparently you were kept things going by a series of terrible jokes. You're just so awful with that. They kind of kept things moving or something. I don't know if you keep it up. But this is one of the issues in which...
jokes?
the charismatic thing, in which there was some uncertainty, some sort of how to proceed or how to formulate a statement. Were things left in a concrete way, or are they still up in the air?
Yes. actually, we ran out of time. This, to be very factual about the way that went, we had hoped to adjourn. What was it? About 3:30 was our maximum time, our outside time, and we had to extend the time formally, even to find 20 minutes to talk about it. However, we knew from both faculties that we were not going to adopt a policy at this meeting. I mean, we discovered that when the Springfield men arrived, that they felt similarly about it to our feelings. And our feelings were that one of the points was that we want to involve the whole community here in a somewhat patient, careful study of the Word of God on the work of the Holy Spirit. We see no great need to rush into any written policy statement. By the same token, there is a rather strong conviction in our faculty that no person who holds to neo-Pentecostal theology should be placed in the ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And we don't know precisely at this point how to define neo-Pentecostal theology in such a way, in writing, in a policy statement, that it's clear in advance that if you have such and such an attitude, or do such and such things, or articulate your experience of the Holy Spirit in such and such a way, then you are a neo-Pentecostal. Now, any other questions? Otherwise, Dave, that's a very fine statement from the Formula of Concord, and I wonder whether you could read it for us. It's when you finish, we'll close with the Lord's Prayer and benediction, if we could. For those of you who came in late, this is a statement that appears at the end of Article 11 of the Formula of Concord. Now, for the benefit of the ladies and others who haven't studied the Formula of Concord, that was written in the 1570s, almost precisely 400 years ago, at the end of the most bitter conflict in the history of Lutheranism. I mean, we think we have problems today. Ours are rather mild compared to what went on in German Lutheranism after the death of Luther. Between 1547 and 48, the Leipzig interim, all the way to 1577, took them 30 years of talking and writing and working before they were able to adopt a formula for concord. And it has become one of the confessional writings of the church. So there are only 12 articles in this whole thing. At the end of the 11th article, as they're getting tired of writing and winding up their great confession, this is how they end it, and they talk about concord in the church. So, with that background, why don't we listen to Dave?
Paragraphs 95 and 96, tablet, page 632, by the way. From our exposition, friends and foes may clearly understand that we have no intention, since we have no authority to do so, to yield anything of the eternal and unchangeable truth of God for the sake of temporal peace, tranquility, and outward harmony. Nor would such peace and harmony last, because it would be contrary to the truth and actually intended for its suppression. Still less by far are we minded to whitewash or cover up any falsification of true doctrine or any publicly condemned errors. We have a sincere delight in and deep love for true harmony, and are cordially inclined and determined on our part to do everything in our power to further the same. We desire such harmony as will not violate God's honor, that will not detract anything from the divine truth of the Holy Gospel, that will not give the place to the smallest error, but will lead the poor sinner to true and sincere repentance, raise him up through faith, strengthen him in his new obedience, and thus justify and save him forever through the sole merit of Jesus Christ, and so forth.
Very good. Well, thank you for coming.